Esther so far in the Old Covenant and the Book of Acts, chapter 18 in the New Covenant. So we'll really just introduce the Book of Esther up through chapter 2 as of today. We'll finish the Book of Esther this week and almost finish the Book of Acts next week, and then be into the Book of Job next week. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about Esther tonight and Nehemiah and anything that we got in the Book of Acts or anything up to this point. So anybody got any questions, anything you ran across while you were reading that you thought would be good to kick around tonight? Everybody's up to date on their reading? This is the first time I've ever done a read through the Bible in this way, and I got to say, I kind of am enjoying this just because it's a little bit different. I've read the Old Testament, New Testament before, but I've never just done 5-day readings, so it's a little different. It's a wad, I guess, for some people, about 5 chapters a day. If you read 4 chapters a day, you'll read through the Bible in a year, and so this figures out to about 5 chapters a day on average. Gives you the weekend off. Or
is that a question? But like the prayer in Nehemiah 9, like, I was just thinking it was really cool how like it's not straight to the Lord's Prayer, but it kind of does with how it starts out, like blessed be thy glorious name, hallowed be thy name. But it goes through and it starts off like talking about how God is powerful.
Truly amazing. And Nehemiah 9 is one of those wonderful places where it's just a fantastic survey of the people of God. It's one chapter. It's it's kind of like Paul's prayer, or Paul's sermon that we talked about on Sunday morning. You know how he, in one verse, he sums up, six chapters of the Bible, Well, that's what Nehemiah 9 does. And something similar, of course, is Stephen's message and address to the Jewish people in the Book of Acts. He does something very, very similar to that, where he just, it's one of those great places. There's also Psalm, and I can't think of it right off the top of my head which one it is, but it's the same kind of thing, and he just surveys everything. It's kind of like a summary of that. But you're right, and that is fascinating how that prayer almost parallels the Lord's Prayer in that way. It's just fantastic. Nehemiah 9 is a great place to go just for if you wanted to give somebody a little quick refresher on this is the summary of the Old Testament, Nehemiah 9 is a great place to go and do that. All kind of summed up in one chapter. Fantastic. I especially like verse 17, the last part. As he talks about how they were stiff-necked and refused to obey. But thou art a God ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and forsook them not. Isn't that magnificent as he just reminds us of God's character in the midst of God's people being stiff-necked and hard-hearted? So, yeah, that's awesome. Anybody else come across anything interesting? Questions? Take a look at Nehemiah 5 real quick. There's some interesting things in Nehemiah that I found interesting anyway. Nehemiah 5:14, we learn there, it says, "Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor the land of Judah." So Nehemiah, he asked permission to return and to rebuild the gates and the walls of the city of Jerusalem. But that's not all he does. It's not just a building project. It really is an establishing of government project. And one of the things that we see in the book of Ezra, Ezra and Zerubbabel, when they return, their primary emphasis is on rebuilding the altar and rebuilding the temple. But the city of Jerusalem is still in ruins as they're doing this, and the government is a mess. There really is very little government. And Ezra has got some funds and whatnot to build the temple, but he does not have the authority to establish government. But when Nehemiah comes, he's got not only funds to rebuild and supplies, or the authority to gather supplies, he also has the authority to establish government. So they appoint him the governor, and he has some real serious opposition that he has to deal with. And if you look in chapter 8, back to chapter 5. So it says, this time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year even unto the 2 and 30th year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor. Leah Koch and Donald Trump were the only two people that I can think of that have ever done anything like that. Is there somebody I'm forgetting? I'm sure there are. I don't like Trump, but it sure does impress me. Of course, when you're filthy, stinking rich, you don't have to have that much. But he turns down his paycheck to serve as president. Is that right? Leah Koch did the same thing. He fixed the Chrysler Corporation. He walked in and he said he would do it for $1 a year. And he invested a massive amount of his life into rebuilding a corporation and even taking money from it. Well, that's what Nehemiah did. But look why he did it. He says, not only me, but me and my brethren. And so that means his entire staff. Nobody got paid for doing this. But the former governors that had been before me were chargeable unto the people, and had taken of them bread and wine beside 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bear rule over the people. Barack Obama spent more money out of the presidential treasury than any president before him. He robbed the United States of America. His wife and 40 of her very best friends took multiple vacations and flew in Air Force One and all this money and all these jets. And when Obama went to visit, when he went to see the Taj Mahal, because it was a safety concern, they had to build a tunnel so that he didn't actually walk out in the open. They built a tunnel so that he and his wife could walk over there at this Muslim thing that was built. Anyway, you know, the way that you handle money says an awful lot about you. I mean, it says an awful lot about you. I don't like Trump. And I didn't like Obama, and I didn't like whoever was before all that. But nonetheless, it's really, really interesting to me to see the way that, you know, Nehemiah points this out as he says, hey, we did what we did because this is the right thing to do, not so that we can benefit. We're not here to get rich. We're not here to, you know, everybody here is struggling. Everybody here is having a difficult time. So we didn't take that money. The guys before us, not only did they take the money, but all of their servants did as well. And they've been chargeable to the people. And he says, even their servants bear rule over the people, but so did not I because of the fear of God. And I find that to be, I mean, Nehemiah is definitely a man of integrity. Turn over to chapter 8 real quick. Chapter 8, verse 9. It says, Nehemiah, which is the Tirshathah. That is a really cool word. Anybody know what that means? I like that word, Tirshathah. It just means governor in the Persian language. So we're gonna see more of this as we go into the book of Esther. We're dealing with several different languages here. And when we look back in time on all of these events, we're going to look back through a Greek lens a lot of times at these things. So when you read about these things in secular history, you're going to read Greek names. And the Jews are using Hebrew names to talk about these things, and sometimes Persian names. But they're all dealing with Persian terms as well, because that's the power structure of the world at that time. So Tirshathah is just a word that means governor. Also, look at verse 8, or chapter 8, verse 13. It says, on the second day, we'll gather together the chief of the fathers of all the people, the priests and the Levites, unto Ezra the scribe, even to understand the words of the law. And they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded by Moses. I love that. I just love that. It's like they went on a hunt. You know, it's like it says in Acts of the people of Berea. They searched the scriptures. And that's what I do. Every morning I get up, I get my coffee, and I go in there, and let's go see what I can find today. Right? And so it says, they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths in the feast of the seventh month. This is the Feast of Tabernacles. They're reading the book of Leviticus. And it specifically says that on that month, they're supposed to live in booths. They're supposed to camp out. And he says, and that they should publish and proclaim in all their cities in Jerusalem, saying, go forth unto the mount, fetch olive branches and vine branches and myrtle branches and palm branches and branches of thick trees to make booths, as it is written. So the people went forth, and they brought them and made themselves booths, every one upon the roof of his house, and in their courts, and in the courts of the house of God, and in the street of the water gate, and in the street of the gate of Ephraim. And all the congregation of them that were come again out of the captivity made booths, and sat under the booths, for since the days of Jeshua the son of Nun, that's Joshua, unto that day had not the children of Israel done so. And there was very great gladness. The children of Israel had neglected a portion of the word of God. Oh, they've been keeping the Passover for the most part. Remember during the days of Hezekiah, they had to reinstitute the Passover because it had been, when you had a wicked king, he ignored the word of God, they ignored the feast of the Lord. And so they went for periods of time. Then you come along, King Josiah, they find the book of the law. And it had been years since they'd done this. But these other kings had instituted the Passover, maybe Pentecost, maybe not, we don't know. None of them had instituted the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles since the days of Joshua. And they read it, and they said, what time is it? I said, it's the seventh month. And they said, it's time. And so they did it. And I find that, I mean, it's just fascinating to me. It's fascinating for one thing that the people had ignored all of that. But it's also, it just shows you Nehemiah's heart that he's being very careful. Ezra, they're being very careful. Obey the word. So they're putting these things into practice. And apparently, it was a good time. Also, day by day, from the first day into the last, he read the book of the law of God. They kept the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day was a solemn assembly, according unto the manner. In other words, they just did what the Bible said. And it was a great time. Let's see. Chapter 13. Let's look at chapter 13 right quick. Another real interesting thing about the book of Nehemiah. Now, as we get to the end of Nehemiah, we're going to find that Nehemiah is contemporary with Malachi. Okay, so Malachi the prophet is going to be prophesying at this same period of time. And in this chapter 13, we're going to see that there was basically what Nehemiah was trying to do, what Ezra was trying to do, is get the people back into the land, get the temple reestablished, altar and the sacrifices reestablished, rebuild the wall, kick everybody out that wasn't supposed to be there, and get right with God. And as he began to do these things, he began to find some problems. Okay, first of all, Tobiah the Ammonite was living in one of the temple rooms. Well, that was a bad deal because no Ammonite was ever to be allowed into the temple ever. But it turns out that Tobiah, he's been, Nehemiah, there's two guys that give the Jews a really hard time in trying to rebuild Jerusalem. Tobiah and Sanballat. Okay? It turns out that Sanballat is, okay, let me see. Eliashib was the high priest, and his buddy was Tobiah the Ammonite. So he just let him have a room at the temple. You know, just move in, right? Well, is anyone besides a priest or a Levite, then they're not even supposed to be near this thing. But this is an Ammonite who's living there. Not only that, but the grandson of the priest, the grandson of Eliashib, was married to Sanballat's daughter. Now Sanballat is the governor of Samaria. So he's going to be Persian or a Assyrian who was appointed as the governor in Samaria, and he's still got all kinds of sway going on down in Judah. But Eliashib's grandson, if he's a priest, what's his grandson going to be? Supposed to be. He'll become a priest someday as well, right? This is a family thing. Well, he's married to Sanballat's daughter. Sanballat is a Horonite. A priest, if we go back and look in the law of Moses, he could not marry a divorced woman. He could not marry a woman that had, he had to marry a virgin. And he could not marry a woman outside of Israel. Other Israelites, they were not supposed to marry the Canaanite tribes, but they could take wives from other areas, but not a priest. So he's married a Horonite's daughter. And so Nehemiah boots him out. And he boots Eliashib out because of his fraternizing with the Ammonites. He runs Tobiah out. We read of part of the rebuilding that's taking place, that they had to have a trowel in one hand and a weapon in the other as they worked, because their enemies were basically at the gates trying to put a stop to what they were doing. Not only that, but he found out that portions were not being given to the Levites. He found out that they were doing business on the Sabbath day. These foreign merchants were coming and they were peddling fish and all kinds of different things on the Sabbath day. And so Nehemiah commanded that the gates be locked. They didn't let them out in and out on the Sabbath day. And he found out that lots and lots and lots of them had married the women that were from these Canaanite tribes. Ezra found the same thing. And so Ezra sat down with them all and ripped his garments and put on sackcloth. And he said that he blushed from shame. He was so embarrassed that the people of God would do something like this. And they all sit down and they mourned and they fasted and they said, what are we going to do? And so they formed a covenant and they said, we're going to put them all away. And so they had a massive divorce. All of these foreign wives were divorced from these Israelite men. And Nehemiah comes at a later time. Look at verse 25. It says, and I contended with, let's look at verse 23. In those days also I saw a Jews that had married wives of Ashdod. That's a Philistine city of Ammon and of Moab. And their children spake half of the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language. Now, that might not seem like a big deal to us, but you're trying to rebuild a nation. Nehemiah loves his country. Nehemiah hasn't been in his country in at least 70 years. Okay? Probably most of his life. Alright? And yet he loves his country. And he's going, these kids don't even speak Hebrew. Right? Now, for you and I, what difference does that make? Well, for them it was a huge deal, because if you don't speak Hebrew, what can you not do? You can't read the Bible. And so he's absolutely blown away. But according to the language of each of the people. And I contended with them. I don't think Nehemiah won any popularity contest at all. When you think about godly men, you think about sweet and nice, they stand like this, they smile at everyone, they never raise their voice. Well, this is Nehemiah. He said, I contended with them. That means I fought with them. I'm sure he raised his voice. Oh, yeah, he did, because he cursed them. And he smote certain of them, and he plucked off their hair. Man, now that's a business meeting. Wouldn't that be great? So how was the Baptist business meeting this last week? You won't believe it. The preacher yelled, spit, cursed, held one guy down, slapped him around, and yanked out his hair. Is he still there? Oh, no. No, we ran that preacher off. No, they don't. They don't run Nehemiah off. Nehemiah deals with them. I plucked off their hair and I made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourself. Now watch what he does. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? See, he's learned the lessons, and he's so upset with them because they haven't. Didn't we see Solomon do this? Yet among many nations was there no king like him. who's beloved of his God. And God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God and marrying strange wives? And so, I just thought I'd point that out, lest you miss that in your reading. I'm thinking old Nehemiah's knuckles drug the ground. I mean, this guy, let's think about this. This guy is the cupbearer for the king of Persia. Right? Now that, you know, that's the guy who tastes his wine, makes sure it's not poison. Well, sort of. Yeah, that's probably one of his functions, but who do you trust to do that? This is the right-hand man of the king of Persia. That's what this is. This is the Ahithophel to David. The Hushai to David. That's who he is to the king of Persia. This is an extremely important, influential, powerful man. This is Joseph to Pharaoh. The most powerful king on the planet. This is his right-hand man, his most trusted man, the man who deals with, he has wisdom in affairs of state, in battle, in plans, in everything. And yet, because of the love that he has for his nation and for his God, he asks permission, at risk of his own life, by the way. I mean, the king could have turned him down. Matter of fact, the reason the king asked Nehemiah about what he was doing in the first place was because Nehemiah looked depressed. And the law of the Medes and Persians was against the law to be depressed. So Nehemiah's countenance was fallen. He was moping around, and the king said, "What's wrong with you?" So he took a deep breath. He said a quick little prayer in his heart. And he said, "I got word the gates of the city are burned. The walls are in trembles. And I want to go back and I want to rebuild it." Oh, he tells him the problem first. And he says, "Well, what do you want to do about it?" He says, his pocket, he pulls out a yellow notebook, pad of paper, one page. Just hold it up. He says, "I want to go back. I want time to go back. I want money to go back. I want troops to go with me. I want to take people with me. I want to do this. I want to build this. I need this, 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 this." And he had this whole plan. "Here's what I want." He says, "Okay, go." So he goes back. He has to fight the battles. He has to, there's espionage taking place. He has to secretly do recon mission at night to find out what's going on because it's so dangerous. He finds out that there is an attempt on his life. They're trying to lure him out to a certain place to kill him. He has to avoid that. He has to, is this guy a builder? No. Were those people builders? Probably not. Not only that, he's very honest because he asks God, "Please don't forget what I've done for you, Lord." I find that the first time I ever read Nehemiah, I found that to be petty, I suppose. But the more that I read it, the more that I realize what Nehemiah is doing is, and by the way, some people think that this is compiled from Nehemiah's memoirs and think Ezra's the one who actually wrote all this down. I don't know. Ezra and Nehemiah 1. But what's so fascinating about that is Nehemiah is doing this because of his love of God. And he wants that to be recognized. He wants for God to know why he's doing what he's doing. So I find it incredible. What he finds when he gets there is he finds nepotism. He finds apathy, lethargy. He finds, the place is a mess. Nobody wants to have responsibility for their actions. And he just starts yanking people around, telling people what to do, pulling people's hair if need be, cursing them and fighting them to the ground until he gets it done. And so Nehemiah is a book about leadership. Now, I don't suggest doing any of those things, okay? I'm not suggesting that. I just want to point that out to you. If the thought ever went through your mind that Nehemiah was this nice guy who would win some kind of award for being sweet and kind, I don't think so. I think Nehemiah was a get-her-done kind of guy who, when he got an idea in his head, you better look out because he's fixing to make it happen. So, find that fascinating. Okay, Esther. We started on Esther a little bit. I want to do a little bit of a survey of Esther. Really, I'm not going to do the survey because you already know the story of Esther real well. Here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about where Esther fits in all this. Esther's already happened by the time of Nehemiah, okay? So So Esther's over here. Now, Esther serves a, winds up being the queen to King Ahasuerus. Now, that is a Jewish word. The guy's name is really, really hard to say in the Persian language, but in the Greek language, anybody know what his name is in Greek? This is Xerxes, okay? So when you... Xerxes, how do you spell it? So when you think about this, when Vashti is summoned, okay? Vashti is the great-granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So when Cyrus takes over Persia, when he defeats the Babylonians, right? They divert the water course up a creek and walk underneath the wall of the city. Well, now the Babylonian Empire falls to the Persians. Well, Cyrus, his wife was a Mede, so he takes the Medes and Persians, brings them together, okay? He's whooped by the Greeks, and when Xerxes whips the Persians, right? No, Xerxes is his Greek name, so we haven't faced the Greeks yet, but he's going to. He's going to try to be the guy who's going to invade Greece, okay? So he takes the granddaughter of great-granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. That's who Vashti is. She was a little bitty girl when he marries her. So she's much younger than him, and apparently she was smoking hot, and he gets drunk, and he's got all his buddies around, and he wants her to come and to show herself. Now, whatever that means, I don't know, but whatever it was, probably wasn't appropriate. And she says no. Well, the big deal is you know, and all of his, he's got all of his chief liaisons, his other generals, his other kings. He's got the whole leadership there. And so they say, he says, what are we going to do about this? They say, well, we can't let this be. She's the first lady. If she gets away with this, we'll have women rebelling against their husbands all over. And they decide, that's right, we got to do something about it. Well, strip her of her crown. Trade her in for a younger model and get a new one. So the old king just puts out a decree, goes to gather up all the beautiful women in the entire nation. And out of all of that, Esther's the one who's picked. Now, here's what's cool. Esther's cousin, Mordecai, he's raising her. He's much older than her. Her parents are dead. So Mordecai realizes what's going on. He tells her, don't you tell them that you're a Jew, whatever you do, okay? At the same time, there's a guy named Haman. And Haman is the sorriest slime of human that there is. Because he's willing to do anything to get his way. He wants to sell. He's a self-promoter. Everything that he does is based on greed and ambition. And he's always snuggling in bestest best buddies with the king. So, if we follow their lineage, Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. He is a descendant of Kish and also of Shimei. Remember Shimei? When Absalom, long time before, when Absalom takes over the kingdom and forms a coup against his father, David and all of his mighty men and all of his trusted advisors abandon Jerusalem. As they go, a fellow named Shimei, I may not be saying that exactly right, a descendant of Kish. Saul is a descendant of Kish. Saul's father is Kish. Shimei is also, so Shimei and Saul are kin. And Shimei curses David and throws rocks at him. Remember that story? And one of David's mighty men says, King, I'll go take his head off for you. David says, no. Maybe God's told him to do this. He's cursing me. Maybe I deserve it. Let him live. Leave him alone. Okay? Mordecai is a descendant of his. So David showed Shimei grace, even though he didn't deserve it. Okay? Haman.
Haman is an Agagite. Agag is the king of the Amalekites. Moses had to fight the Amalekites, he and Joshua, when they were wandering in the wilderness. Remember the story? This is the one where Moses' hands were held up, Joshua had victory, Moses got tired, his hands went down, the Amalekites began to win. So God declared, because the Amalekites attacked them, God declared that the Amalekites were cursed and that they would be destroyed. So Samuel told Saul to destroy the Amalekites, to kill them all, to destroy all of their cattle, everything, take no spoil. Saul whipped the Amalekites, killed all the soldiers, kept all the rest of the people alive, and kept the king, Agag. He kept all the cattle and all the sheep. Samuel shows up and he says, "Why did you not obey God?" Saul says, "I did. I whipped them." He said, "No, I told you to kill them all." And he says, "Well, we saved the best of them alive to offer a sacrifice to your God." Remember the story from 1 and 2, from 1 Samuel? Well, that king that he spared? Okay. So what we have is, we thought all these guys are gone because Samuel kills Agag. He takes a sword and hacks him to pieces. And Solomon executed Shimei once he became. But David showed Shimei grace, and hundreds of years later, like 400 years later, one of Shimei's descendants is a fellow named Mordecai, who loves God, who's very wise, and who knows what's going on, and at the same time, his mortal arch enemy is a descendant of Agag. So this all goes back to Saul and his fleshly choices. David is a spiritual man. He shows a man grace. And from that grace comes a descendant named Mordecai, who God uses, God placed. I mean, for hundreds of years, God's been playing this chess game, moving these people around. I mean, the entire Amalekites were all wiped out that day. Guess not. Agag's descendants were spared somehow because this fellow Haman shows up. Saul had done what God told Saul to do, we would have never come to this point. But not only that, if Haman had been successful in doing what he wanted to do and wiping out all the Jews, there would have never been a temple, there would have never been the rebuilding of Jerusalem, there would have been Nehemiah and all of them, they would have all been wiped out had Haman been successful. Now, throughout time, there have been some people who have debated whether the book of Esther should actually be in the Bible or not, because it doesn't mention the name of God in the book. Now, that's only partially true because several years ago, maybe 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, they came up with some stuff, they found some things called the Bible codes. Now, even as I say that, let me just say, be very careful with all of that, okay? But what's so fascinating is, and people have known this for hundreds of years, there are equidistant letter sequences of the name of God in the book of Esther that are hidden there. So if you take a sentence, I started to write them down, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. Anyway, it only works in Hebrew anyway. But if you take a sentence, and you take every sixth letter, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So you use this letter, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, this letter, 2, 3, 4, like that. It spells out Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in four different places. The name of Jesus is also contained there. Okay? Now, that is not doctrine. But what that shows you is design. That doesn't happen by accident, especially four different times in the book. So it's just one of those little things that you sometimes run across that just kind of help you to realize. But here's the deal. It doesn't have to mention the name of God because it's all about the people of God. And it's obvious, especially through this, to see the hand of God at work in what's going on. What this is about, Book of Esther is all about providence. God did all of this. By the way, this guy is going to invade Greece. this guy, when he has his big party, I mean, this party lasts for months. The reason he's having this party is because he's got all of his generals there. He's showing off all of his might, all of his power, and they're all getting all woo-woo-woo banging their chest, right? Because they're making plans to invade. And in 480, he's going to begin his quest. And a king named Leonidas is going to disobey his oracle and his orders, and he's going to turn in his crown and take 300 men and go to the hot gates of Thermopylae and put a stop to Xerxes' troops. And at exactly the same time, there's going to be two huge, massive naval battles that are going to take place just right up the coast from there. One of them, Xerxes' ships are going to win, but the other one is going to cripple Xerxes, and the Greeks, who are massively outnumbered. When you read Herodotus' numbers, we're talking about millions of soldiers that came from Persia. And all of this is all getting set up. That party that Vashti refuses to come and entertain all of Xerxes' buddies, that was the planning for the massive invasion of the Persians against the Greeks. Probably. Of course, it's debated by scholars if that's actually what was happening. But the time frame, I mean, within just a year or so after that takes place, that invasion is gonna happen. And Xerxes is gonna get whooped. But his, you read, as you read about this in the book of Esther, you see what Xerxes was he was a maniac. He was just like many world leaders. He was, at one moment he'd be showing incredible grace, and then he'd just turn around and just kill everybody. He built a bridge over the Hellespont, which is this huge, massive thing that it would have had to go over this. Well, the big sea storm comes and tears his bridge down. Well, he had all of his people go out there and give the water 300 lashes for tearing down his bridge. So they went out there, had them all out there whipping the water. And he got all the engineers responsible for building the bridge, and he cut all their heads off. And then he turned around and said, build one that the water can't tear down. So then they had to go back, and he's just crazy. The guy's crazy. He wasn't 7 feet tall, for those of you who've seen the movie. Anyway. The amazing thing about the book of Esther, I think, is the fact that the providence of God and working all of these things out, and it's somebody said one time, they said, when I pray, coincidences happen. And when I don't pray, coincidences don't happen. I mean, Esther may not mention the name of God, but she calls for prayer before she goes to see the king. Because she can't do that. Even though she's the queen, she can't have an audience with the king unless she is invited. So when she goes to see the king, she could lose her life. But I love in chapter 4, Mordecai, in chapter 4, verse 13, it says, Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape from the king's house more than all the Jews. See, she's kind of waffling. He's telling her, this is what you have to do. You've got to put a stop to this. He says, for if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. You know what? I mean, here's Mordecai. You talk about a man of faith. Mordecai says, look, don't think you're going to be spared if this all happens, because you're a Jew and they're going to find out. Old Haman, he knows. He's got a pretty good idea if he doesn't know. But if you refuse to do this, well, God's just going to raise up somebody else to do it. Deliverance is going to come to these people. Why? Because the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Mordecai knows that. People of God are going to prevail, right? There's going to perpetually be someone to sit on the throne of David. He says, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Magnificent. I mean, what an incredible statement of faith that is. Enlargement will come to the Jews from some other place. In other words, he doesn't say God will do this some other way, but that's what he means. It's going to happen. God's going to make sure that the Jewish people survive one way or the other. How do you not know? See, there's no miracle here. There's no miracle in the book. There's no open revelation. There's no prophet who says, thus saith the Lord. But there's a godly man and a godly young lady, too. She has to be talked into it. But there's a godly man who believes the word of God and who loves his nation, loves his people. He also is faithful to the kingdom that he's in. Mordecai finds out about a plot to kill Xerxes. Well, instead of going, yes, down with the king, he tells Esther, hey, let him know they're going to try to kill him. And that's actually another incredible plot twist in the story as you read it. But I love Esther's reply. Verse 16 of chapter 4. Go, gather all together, all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast you for me. Neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. You know who that reminds me of when I read that? Who's that remind you of? Think of anybody? It kind of does. Let it be to me according to the Lord's word. It kind of sounds like Mary. Great. That's what you say. Amen. Who else? David. King David. Well, in his refusal to attack Saul, he's kind of like, hey, you know, kind of like with Shimei too. If God's ready to destroy me, well, then he'll get it. Yeah, kind of does. Jonathan kind of had an attitude like that. If they say, come over here, well, then we'll show you a thing or two. Well, then we'll know God's given in our hands. And if they say, stay where you are, well, we'll know we're dead. Yeah, he kind of did. It reminds me of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they stood up and they said, look, O king, if you can tell us to do this all you want to, and don't you worry, God is able to save us. But if he doesn't, well, we're still going to glorify him, and we're still going to honor him. And, you know, that's up to him whether we live or not. But it's up to us whether we obey or not. And that's the conclusion that Esther comes to. Mordecai has to remind her. He has to kind of talk her into it. I'm sure she was mortified, just terrified to do what she had to do. It's a great story. It's a great story. Matter of fact, probably one of the neatest plot twist dramas in all of life, if you just get right down to it, you know. And this is where the Feast of Purim comes from. The Jews, ever since that day, have celebrated that. Of Purim. It's not one of those feasts. There's a couple of feasts the Jews celebrate. One is Hanukkah and one is Purim. And neither one of those are listed in the law of Moses. Purim is because of this incident that came about because of Queen Esther, or Hadassah, which is her Hebrew name. The other one is Hanukkah. And Hanukkah came about because of the deliverance that comes during the intertestamental period when they reestablished the temple in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid megalomaniac.
Yep, history is full of crazy people in positions of leadership, isn't it? It's amazing.
So, anyway, any questions, thoughts? It's great. Better. Anybody who ever says reading the Bible is boring has never read the Bible. It's not boring. It's absolutely fascinating. Don't think that God doesn't know the end from the beginning. As you read Esther, you just see how he has just arranged all of these things and put all these things in place. So, fascinating. All right, let me pray for you.